Don't you know? We're talking about a revolution. Sounds.
It's Freedom News Hour Possibilities. I'm your host, Paul Houston, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, July 24th, 2014, and here are the topics we'll be looking at today. We're going to look at the two court rulings on the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. We'll also take a look at what it takes to get placed on a terror watch list. Apparently, it's now easier than ever before. If we can get to it, we're also going to talk about how the drug war has impacted minors from the Central and South American countries and how the influx of such immigrants has skyrocketed. But we're starting off with yet another Edward Snowden-based story about the NSA, once again, this time reporting that they have the ability and have been actively pursuing the action of basically tracking everything that anyone does with credit cards and wire transfers. And apparently, Bill, the EU doesn't like that too much.
I'm disappointed because they don't have a good name for it. There's supposed to be an acronym or the monkey or something like that, but it's just called Follow the Money. So there's an NSA branch called Follow the Money.
It's not a good acronym, but it's a good phrase.
Well,
I mean, that's the basis for most criminal tracking, so it sounds like it's legitimate on the surface.
They could have come up with something more creative, as they usually do. In any case, I mean, it's no surprise or shock that economic warfare is quickly becoming the preferred method of destroying other countries, and the NSA wants to monitor it, and that's what they're doing. A lot of people may not know that the SWIFT system is a international currency exchange market that was set up by the U.S. decades ago. Basically, whenever you convert one currency to another through the SWIFT system, it first goes through being converted to U.S. dollars and then from U.S. dollars to the other currency. Now, we've been talking for the past several weeks about all these new developments between China and Russia and Britain and Venezuela and dozens of other countries, Japan too. To set up an alternative to the SWIFT system, which puts a real bone in the nose of the NSA, because they aren't necessarily going to be able to monitor the currency transactions that are going through this alternative system. Director of the U.S. National Intelligence said that the NSA collects financial information provide the U.S. and our allies early warning of international financial crises, which could negatively impact the global economy. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's in our national interest to know what everybody else is doing, and that's what the SWIFT system allows.
And this is basically supposed to protect all of us, right?
It's supposed to make all currency transactions internationally subject to U.S. permission and U.S. evaluations of the various currencies, because they have to go into a dollar before they can go into something else. So it's not a matter of protecting us. The SWIFT system is designed to maintain economic control, so that when we want to punish somebody, whether it's Russia or Iran or whoever, when they impose sanctions, that's how they enforce it, is through the SWIFT system. So you can't convert, particular people or particular countries can't convert into other currencies through the SWIFT system unless the U.S. knows about it, because the U.S. knows about all the U.S. transactions. It's pleasing to see that there is an alternative system. There's actually going to be some competition among the two different methods of exchanging currencies. What effect that will have, I'm not sure.
Well, I think we've already seen at least a little piece of it. That's what this particular story is about that we're reporting on. It appeared in Spiegel.de because the EU Parliament was upset about all this, to the point that they're at least talking about taking some kind of action, primarily because it flies directly in the face of some legislation that they themselves passed within the last year or two designed specifically to protect and prevent against this kind of thing. So here's the NSA undermining what they did. And they make them look really bad among their constituents, which, of course, they don't like too much, you know. So they want to look good to their constituents. And as a result, that actually pushes one of the few allies we have that would actually perhaps want to stay with the dollar the longest away from the dollar. It has one of those peculiar side issues to it, because, like you're saying, the system that the Russians and the Chinese and so forth are trying to set up basically bypasses the U.S. dollar in terms of international currency-based exchanges. You do that, you knock the NSA out of the loop, and you also simultaneously support this competitive enterprise. So basically, we're pushing the Europeans over toward the Chinese and the Russians. It's very interesting.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, I mentioned up top that economic warfare is becoming the norm. And the U.S. can't impose its will on economic transactions if they don't, you know, other countries don't aren't using the SWIFT system. They're using some other currency trading system. When, you know, Obama says, well, you know, here's 12 Russians and they can't any longer access the SWIFT system, hey, they're going to say, fine, no problem, we'll just go the other way. There's a parallel to some degree, and there hasn't been any news on it, but the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, mm-hmm. is essentially financed and controlled by the U.S. government, primarily by the Treasury. And so that's another aspect of these agreements that Russia and China are making with these other countries, is setting up an alternative to the IMF, which the U.S. will not control. So I think, you know, I suppose for somebody who is a real paranoid that this is going to be a huge disaster and it sets up conflicts and it, makes U.S. intervention in economic activities difficult and if not impossible. But I see that as a very positive sign, seeing people declaring their independence from U.S. Treasury domination.
I just hope that it doesn't mean that it makes it difficult for Americans, not the NSA, not the government, but just basic everyday Americans to engage in private trade outside of our borders, because if that becomes the case, and I suspect that is going to become the case, then first of all, it'll mean that we can't actually do trade in dollars anymore. And second of all, it's going to really wreak havoc with the dollar, because once again, this is pushing us in the direction of the dollar no longer being a reserve currency of the world. And I mean, there's a plus side to that. The plus side is that the Federal Reserve and the U.S. government can no longer get away with all their shenanigans that they pulled with the money supply just because of that role that the U.S. dollar has. So I guess that's a good thing. They can't do that anymore. But the bad thing is all of the stuff that we are used to being protected from that are normally inflationary and that don't show up because either the bureaucrats don't count the numbers accurately or they fudge the statistics or whatever, or, you know, more directly, more boldly, because the Federal Reserve and the U.S. dollar are essentially at the root of the world monetary system, they can get away with doing more. I mean, they've gotten away with what? Tripling the balance sheet of the Fed and huge amounts of monetary expansion that doesn't actually produce any dramatic horrors for us yet. I mean, it will eventually, but just hasn't done it yet. So that's a tool that's taken away. And you keep taking these tools away, and pretty soon, you know, any little shift, any little change that happens in the monetary system and the government spending, the overall economic structure of the GDP, and it gets felt very quickly and very painfully across the entire economy. So there's a plus and a negative to it.
Yeah, it also has an effect on debt, too, because treasury bonds are the reserve currency for dozens and dozens of countries around the world. They no longer have to do that. What I found fascinating was that two of our staunchest allies, Britain and Japan, have agreed to participate in this alternative exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really an astounding rebuke to the U.S. Management of the financial system.
Right. So now here we have the EU taking the step of saying, well, we don't like the fact that you're spying on us through the SWIFT system, thereby driving the rest of Europe over into that camp. There isn't going to be a whole lot left in our camp.
Yep. Now from the perspective of, if I were a big corporation and not part of the corporatist moguls, I'd be very concerned about this because a lot of the intervention the U.S. does is on behalf of large corporations, particularly the military-industrial complex. I think it's encouraging. I think the effect is going to be beneficial, even for U.S. citizens in the long run. We may have to, exchange our dollars for Japanese wands instead of U.S., going into some other exchange market than the SWIFT system. So it's not something anybody's going to really notice, but the effect on international diplomacy is going to be huge.
Yeah, well, they're also going to notice it in the long run. They just won't know what the connection is because
right.
They've been clueless all along. But, yeah, they're definitely going to experience it. It's just a question of when and how badly. And that's the big question. You're right. There is some positive to this. There's a positive side to it. There's one thing we should kind of watch. It's something that bears watching, and you just kind of touched on it indirectly. That is, once the U.S. becomes less and less of an attractive place for corporations to do business, it's going to be interesting to see what kind of pace there is in terms of corporations deciding to move out of the U.S.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, it's the U.S. has the highest corporate tax rate in the world, and Congress is having hearings and trying to figure out what can we do. Of course, the obvious solution is just lower the corporate tax rate, but that means they lose some money on their income. This whole transition which is occurring of the U.S. corporations suddenly becoming Swiss corporations or Russian corporations or British corporations or whatever protects them from the U.S. corporate law. And so there's a great tussle and argument going on in the economic community about how do we solve this problem of U.S. companies going overseas, making their headquarters in Japan or even Korea. It's going to be interesting to see what desperate measures they try to impose on U.S. corporations that are trying to move their headquarters abroad.
Well, you mentioned the idea of cutting corporate taxes, and I don't see that happening, not the least of which because the left would blow a gasket if they did that. For better or for worse, the left claims to be opposed to corporations, but they actually do everything they can to maintain corporate status without actually saying that they do so. But this would be one case where they'd actually prefer that the corporations leave. That creates all kinds of interesting scenarios to go along with it because, well, first of all, it means jobs start leaving. And while I personally don't buy into the whole idea that corporate jobs are a great thing, nevertheless, some of the best paid people in the country work corporate. And that's been true for a long, long time. While you start taking these corporate jobs and sending them out of the country, you get a new kind of unemployment. That kind of unemployment is among what the left are considered to be the wealthier classes. Which I would call the middle class or the upper middle class. And that becomes a thing, as they say, in political circles. Because ultimately, regardless of what the left says at this point, this becomes basically an electability thing. The one group that the politicians know that they don't dare alienate too much if they want to get reelected is the middle class. And that would be a direct hit at the middle class.
Yeah, it puzzles me a little bit. Why progressives favor a corporate income tax? Because all those taxes are being paid by consumers.
I think
the corporation is just a collection agency for the IRS.
We do know why they oppose why they want the corporate income tax, because it's a way of opposing all the terrible things that corporations are known to do.
If you look at a chart, the U.S. Corporate tax rate is like 40%. Every other country in the world is half that or less. Europe is about one quarter.
Let's fall back. The actual aid level is closer to around 15%. Yes, there was a 40% tax bracket, but almost nobody ever hits it. 15%.
Yeah. No, I mean there is a thing there's a gross difference between the flat rate and the actual real percentage that corporations are paying. of course, they've been happy to have a 40% rate as long as they have all kinds of exceptions and subsidies and so on and so forth. And that's why they go to D.C., and that's why they get laws passed, and that's why they do all the manipulation of the economic system, is because they want to get themselves out from under the tax burden without people noticing. And they can say that the tax rate is 40%. Well, we're only paying 12% or 15%, but the rate is 40%. Yeah.
And
so
the
difference.
It's going to have ramifications throughout the entire federal budget. For instance, Obamacare. Obamacare itself is in many ways a subsidized system. We know that. And that subsidy ultimately gets backed by the taxpayer. Well, the taxpayer is in large part the corporation. So if you start running into trouble with Obamacare and you have to start paying for Obamacare out of tax dollars, which between you and me, I actually don't think they do. They end up printing the money. But assuming that you do it the way that they say they're going to do it, you have more tax dollars from the corporations to do that with. And that's particularly significant given what happened this past week with the federal court, because we had those two opposite rulings about the subsidies involved in the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, we've talked in past weeks about the fact that most people weren't aware, and that is that Obamacare gives the insurance companies a guarantee.
Right.
And their theory when they wrote the legislation, and this is thousands of pages of, you know, all kinds of machinations, but basically they said, well, you know, it'll balance out. Some insurance companies will make enough money, some will make too much money, some will make too little money, and we'll just take the difference and pass it around so that the worst performers get tax dollars as compensation and the best performers pay tax dollars into the system. So that there's an insurance guarantee, you know, essentially a bailout to try to, maintain control of the level of profits of the insurance companies. But, yeah, I mean, it's there were two Supreme Court rulings this past week. And what I found totally amusing was that both of the courts, ruling on one side or the other, agreed that the law was so vague and incoherent and contradictory and crazy that they couldn't make a decision, and therefore they decided to defer to the executive branch, or not, depending upon the court. But the idea that a law is unconstitutionally vague has totally disappeared. It used to be the Supreme Court would throw out a law if they couldn't understand it. Yep. Well, now if they can't understand it, they say, well, any interpretation is good.
Well, more precisely, they come up with separate interpretations, and in this case, the two interpretations contradict each other.
Well, these are the district courts, and there's like four or five different suits that are arguing that Obamacare, as written, allows only subsidies and mandates to places where states where they have set up their own state health care exchange. I mean, that's what the law literally says. And so this the argument is in the different courts is, well, this provisional law explicitly says that you can't have these subsidies, you can't have these mandates unless the state agrees. Well, 36 states said, to heck with that. You know, we're not going to set up an exchange. And so the court looks at it and says, well, you know, this is called the Affordable Care Act and Patient Protection Act of the U.S., and the intention of Congress was to make everything better. So if the law doesn't make things better, then they have the power to change it. And that's what Obama's been doing 20, 30 times. He just changes the law. And so it's going to be interesting to see what comes of these court cases, which will eventually end up at the Supreme Court, though it could take another year or so to get there.
One of the comments I love, that I can't remember which Democratic political said it, it may have been even the vice president, I can't remember for sure, but somebody in the party said in the last couple of days that this is an interpretation of a law that shouldn't be difficult for the courts to do, essentially because everyone knows what Congress's intent was. I thought that was kind of amusing, because I'm not sure most people really understand what Congress's intent really was.
Well, the intent was to make every state participate and have their own state exchanges. And there's a provision in the law that says at one point the states shall establish a medical insurance exchange service. Now, the penalty for not doing that is that the state and its residents lose all of the federal subsidies on their health insurance. And Congress said, well, you know, we're going to totally screw them if they don't set up a state exchange, and so obviously they're all going to join. Well, it didn't happen that way. Didn't work. So now it's a choice of whether the judge wants the law to work or doesn't want the law to work. And the wording is very explicit. It says these subsidies and mandates only apply to state exchanges established by the state. So they have to go through all kinds of machinations and syntactical revelations.
Tactical revelations.
I mean, obviously, a federal exchange that's set up by the federal government is established for the state. Of course, that's not what the law says, but it's established for the state. So it's a state exchange, even though it's run by the federal government. So you get into all these, semantic arguments about what one word means. You know, established for the state versus established by the state. It gets down to one little word, and the Supreme Court gets it, and then they decide that, mandate is not really a fine. It's actually a tax, even though the law says it's a fine for not buying health insurance. So that's the mandate ruling. Now, Roberts may come up with, equivalent kind of verbal machination to justify the IRS doing what it does with the subsidies and the mandates, but it'll be fun to watch.
I think they're trying to rewrite Lincoln, a nation of the states, by the states, and for the states, but that's just me. One of the things that gets my attention, though, about this whole thing is something we've talked about quite a bit, which is that there is so much to Obamacare, so much to the Affordable Care Act that was basically put together with chewing gum and baling wire and is, in many cases, poorly thought out, that it makes you wonder how many more of these, I don't want to call them dominoes because it hasn't created the domino effect, but how many more of these linchpins, let's put it that way, how many linchpins have to fall before we see the dominoes start to fall? It hasn't happened yet, but at some point the whole system falls apart because of all these linchpins being pulled. So I don't know. I guess maybe
for example,
positive side to it. But what's the likelihood we're going to start seeing this whole thing happen? This whole basically destruction of Obamacare within the next year or two.
Well, I think it's getting into a legal cascade. More and more people are piling on with more and more, challenges to the basic provisions. Now, remember, this bill was thrown together. There wasn't any reconciliation. There wasn't any, joint committee that went through and double-checked everything. It was rushed through as quickly as it could possibly be passed, as long as the Democrats had a two-thirds majority in the Senate. Well, as soon as Scott Brown was elected to the Senate in Massachusetts, he wouldn't take office for another 2 weeks. That's when the bill was passed, with all kinds of compromises and all kinds of mitigating factors and all kinds of benefits and so on, passed around among the Democrats, who were able to avoid a filibuster as long as they did it before Scott Brown got in the Senate. So it's really, they say that watching legislation be made is a lot like watching sausage being made. Mm-hmm. It's worse than that.
Yeah.
Far worse than that.
Well, you can eat the sausage.
Sausage is at least coherent. You understand what it is. You can read the package, find out what they put in it. But with Obamacare, like Pelosi said, you have to pass it and actually try to implement it before you have any idea what it's all about. And so as a consequence, things like the fact that Obama delayed the employer mandate for a whole year is the primary complaint that the House of Representatives agreed to take to the courts. Basically, Obama is not enforcing the law. He intentionally is not enforcing the law. And his excuse is the law doesn't work and we can't do it, whether it's because of, you know, data problems or exchange problems or financial problems or, you know, whatever it is. The House of Representatives today passed a resolution which doesn't require Obama's signature, saying that the clerk of the court is authorized to sue the administration, and not just Obama, but anybody else in the HHS division, that they haven't been following the constitutional requirement to faithfully execute the laws. They've just been changing them anytime they felt like it.
Well, that perhaps fits in nicely with the next question I wanted to raise about all this, which is there's some speculation that's been raised about one of those two cases, the one that took place in D.C. Regarding that case, that the speculation coming out of it is that this case could ultimately be the taking of the linchpin, if you will, that undermines the whole mandates process and basically could be the beginning of the end of mandates. What do you think? Is that going too far?
Well, like I say, if John Roberts doesn't find some semantic distinction that's totally unrelated to what's in the law, and they actually follow what the law says, and rule that the law says this, and that's what they have to do, the consequence of eliminating the mandates and eliminating the subsidies for all of these federal exchanges, the other 14 states that actually went ahead and set up their state exchange are going to say, the heck with this, and they'll be gone. And so the mandate will be gone, the subsidies will be gone, and the influence of the ACA will be primarily bureaucratic. That is, one of the other sections of the ACA was that a board of medical review or something like that is going to review not just insurance policies, but actual medical practices, and will authorize and dictate what doctors can and can't do and how much the price can and can't be. So there's another whole section that hasn't really been challenged in court yet.
Yeah, we haven't gotten that far. We're still trying to figure out what to do with the mandates. And you raise
right.
the possibility that the 14 or so states that have set up their own state-based exchanges could decide to, you know, throw the mandates out the window. On the other hand, they could also decide to keep them. And in that case, you have this really interesting scenario because those states are primarily blue states. And you have this scenario where basically because of the fact that Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, has that guarantee that you alluded to earlier, where the insurance companies are guaranteed not to lose money, you could effectively have taxes from the red states going to cover the mandates of the blue states that can't cover the total cost of providing these insurance policies out of the existing pool that's there. That's a really interesting scenario because it creates all kinds of dynamics. First of all, it creates the dynamic of the Republicans having to justify why it is that they are sending tax dollars over to the blue states. It also creates the rather uncomfortable and perhaps comfortable, depending on how you look at it, scenario where the Democrats say, well, look how well it's working. We're getting the Republicans to pay our way.
Well, there's an irony here. One of the states that did set up a state exchange was the state that passed its own Obamacare, except it was called Romney Care in Massachusetts.
That's right.
And that was what Obamacare was patterned after. Now, Massachusetts, yeah, I mean, you heard all you wanted to hear about how the federal exchanges were totally screwed up. Massachusetts, running its own exchange, screwed up so bad that they basically threw everything out that they had for their online exchange system and said it's going to take us a year to reprogram this thing so it actually works. So that state and several other states have basically abandoned their state exchange, are asking for hundreds of billions of dollars from the federal government to get it up and running. So that's going to be, you know, another tax expense that wasn't anticipated in the original Obamacare law, which is, you know, I think it was on basis of population. So California and New York got literally hundreds of billions of dollars to promote and build their systems. Massachusetts only got $50 million or whatever it was. So that expense, if the states are going to be subsidized to create state exchanges, is going to cost taxpayers hundreds of billions of dollars.
Well, it could also get you onto a terror watch list, but that we'll have to talk about after the break because we're halfway through the show, okay?
Sure.
This is the Freedom News Hour, Possibilities, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be back after these messages. We're back here on Freedom News Hour, Possibilities. Well, I'm Bill on this Thursday evening. And before the break, I mentioned the terror watch list. The reason I mentioned that is you dug up a story, Bill, that details how the Obama administration very recently approved a substantial expansion of the terrorist watch list system. And the one point that caught my attention as I read about it was that any particular one of a set of individuals within the administration, Obama or otherwise, any presidential administration, one individual can actually put people onto that list. So basically, designating someone as a terrorist and putting them on a watch list comes down to a political function, which is not necessarily the way it was overtly intended. And there are many people who would say that the Obama administration would never do that, but those people who are saying that are probably the left or Democrats. So I would say to them, well, just imagine what happens if the next Republican administration takes office and they decide to start putting people on watch lists. It can work either way. So when you – I was kind of making a joke, but when we're finishing up our discussion about Obamacare there and how all this stuff's happening with the exchanges that could actually lead to people, you know, basically becoming persona non grata where the current administration, whoever they are, is concerned. I was kind of tongue-in-cheek joking, but it was kind of real, too, because putting someone on a terror watch list is a very effective way to essentially bottle somebody up who's a thorn in your side. I think that could actually happen. What do you think? Am I crazy?
It's Nixon's enemies list all over
again. Yeah, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, how you get on the Nixon enemies list and start getting IRS tax audits and you start getting harassed by all kinds of regulatory agencies is that some arbitrary decision is made on a political basis by somebody in the administration that says, oh, I think this person might be a little bit dangerous to us politically, maybe not a terrorist, but, you know, it's a threat to the national interest. They are, and here's the criteria. We suspect, and it's a reasonable suspicion, that these people are trying to undermine the U.S. government.
And we already know of one type of group that the left considers to be in that category, and that would be people.
And a totally different category of people, like Daniel Ellsberg and Edward Snowden.
Yeah,
and
sure.
All the people associated with them, they're undermining the national interest. And so, you know, anybody that expresses sympathy, I mean, here's the Fourth Amendment says, before you can take away people's rights to travel or their rights to engage in commerce or any of the other rights, you have to have probable cause to believe they're involved in a crime. Well, the criteria for getting on this watch list is reasonable suspicion that's determined entirely behind the curtains without anybody knowing why or how they got on a terror watch list, based upon what the administrators considered reasonable suspicion.
Which means they don't have to have facts. They don't have to have evidence. All they have to do is suspect something.
And they don't have to talk to a judge.
That's right.
And the consequences are enormous.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, reasonable suspicion, you know, one guy says to another guy, well, you know, Muslims are really dangerous, right? Oh, yeah, I think that's reasonable. They say that we should be suspicious of all Muslims. So let's put all Muslims on the list. Oh, okay, no problem. Click, 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 click. You know, people who are suing the U.S. government are probably intending to damage our national interests and restrict our powers. So I think it's good reason to be suspicious of them. Let's put them on the terror watch list. Oh, okay, sure, no problem. You know, and some leftist groups, you know, people like the ACLU and a lot of people who are causing government headaches are going to end up on this list. They won't even know they're on the list until they decide they want to take a flight or they decide that they want to exchange their dollars for rubles or yuan or whatever. Because the U.S. government has so much control over the effects of this watch list and the consequences. I mean, the NSA stuff has been used by the FBI for all kinds of drug investigations, sex trafficking investigations, hundreds of different things that has nothing whatsoever to do with terrorism. But the NSA can create this watch list. The FBI gets a copy. The CIA gets a copy. And they start enforcing restrictions on these people who are unnamed, who have no idea that they're on the list.
So and plus, it's not just the NSA. I mean, from what this document that you dug up says, an administration person, not necessarily somebody in the intelligence services or you know, CIA, NSA, that kind of thing, but just someone within the current administration can make that decision to put them on a list.
Yeah.
Which makes it a very, very political act.
Well, and it isn't just the NSA or just the FBI or just the CIA. Any government official can nominate a person to be on the watch list based entirely on what's called fragmentary information. Now, it's interesting. This is not a Snowden thing. This watch list guidance document, 166 pages, was actually released by some whistleblower that was responsible for maintaining this list. And he said, this is crazy. And so he leaked it to Glenn Greenwald. It isn't a Snowden document. It's something that was leaked entirely independent of Snowden.
Is there any word as to whether or not he's gone over to Russia to join Edward Snowden?
Maybe he's on a flight to Hong Kong. I don't know. But it wouldn't surprise me that because this thing is classified, it's a classified document, somebody, and you know, including Glenn Greenwald and the publishers of First Look, which is the new media outlet they formed, could be in for some very nasty scrutiny. And the first thing that's obviously going to happen is it'll be put on the watch list.
Mm-hmm.
So I was surprised that Glenn Greenwald was able to actually fly to the U.S. and do some interviews and things like that. But, you know, based upon this guidance thing, anytime an administration official decides that Glenn Greenwald's a threat to the nation, take away all their flight privileges. They can't land in the U.S.
Go ahead.
Yeah, they did that with Snowden. And it isn't just U.S. flights. They suspected that a Venezuelan ambassador was hiding Snowden on a flight that he was taking from Russia to Venezuela.
That was a couple
months
ago.
And they had stopovers in Europe. And the CIA or the NSA or State Department or whoever called up all those these European countries where the plane might have to land to get fuel, where it had stopovers, and they said, do not allow this plane to land. This guy is harboring Edward Snowden. We want him.
Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence, that plane had to fly in circles for several hours and ended up going back to Russia just because of this cooperation among all of these different countries into enforcing the watch list.
Of course, a more practical, by practical I mean from the perspective of your average American, more practical application of this watch list is you want to fly somewhere within the country. And of course, to do that, you have to go through the TSA. You have to go through the security check lines and so forth. And since we have a couple of minutes left on this particular topic, I thought I'd bring up this other article you dug up where basically the cost, the fees collected for the TSA have doubled, I guess. But they still haven't caught anybody. How long have they been doing this now?
Gosh, I didn't look up to find out how long the TSA has been doing their thing, but it was shortly after 9/11,
right?
That they set up this division in the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration.
We know it's at least 12 to 14 years, something like that.
Yeah. And then they still, there is no documented case in which the TSA has discovered any kind of terrorist trying to get on any kind of flight from the USA. But nevertheless, everybody has to take off their shoes and, you know, put all their stuff through scanners and do body scans and all this other kind of stuff. And in fact, the General Services Administration, the GSA, has done studies on TSA and discovered that 80% of the time, the bans that the TSA are supposed to be enforcing, whether it's, you know, sharp knives or liquids or whatever it is, 80% of the time, the GSA agents can get through airport security without the TSA even noticing.
Mm-hmm. But more to the point of what we were talking about, once you get on one of these watch lists, this is where the TSA's real role comes to the fore, because it's very clear after some 13 years that the TSA is not actually actively preventing anyone from getting on a plane with shoes that are made of gunpowder. That's just not what's going on. But what is happening is that with this new capability that any given current administration official has to put political enemies on watch lists, they're basically enabling the TSA to be the enforcers for the current administration and the current administration's ongoing efforts to get their will put into law at the expense of the opposition.
Yeah.
In other words, stop your opponents by preventing them from flying. That becomes the real role of the TSA. And I remember very explicitly back when President Bush announced the TSA and Congress announced the TSA, they were, you know, saying this will never be used as a political weapon. This is all about protecting the country. And now here we are some 13, 14 years later, and it's being used exactly for what they said it was not going to be used.
Yeah. Well, there's an interesting, you know, side aspect to this, and that is, theoretically, the most efficient way to enforce this watch list is to actually give the airlines the list, so that when somebody buys a ticket, they can say, I'm sorry, you need to get approval from President Obama or whoever.
Mm-hmm.
The latest guy is the TSA. And they can know in advance. But what actually happens is, because they don't want to disclose this list to the airlines, it's confidential, top secret, blah, 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 they can only give it to the TSA. And the TSA, after you've bought your ticket, after you've gone to the airport, after you've gone through the scanner and all this other stuff, looks at your name, finds it on a list, and says, oops, sorry, you can't fly. And then, you know, I have all this hassle of having to get a refund on airline ticket, which is nearly impossible, and all of your plans are totally disrupted, and you have no legal recourse whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
They don't even have to tell you the reason they're not letting you on the plane is because you're on the watch list.
That's right.
That is top secret information.
Yeah, it's a very effective way to deal with your enemies. It really is.
Yep. And
we've been saying that for years here on the show, that this is the kind of thing the TSA is for, the whole terror thing is for. It's about basically preventing political enemies from gaining foothold and using your own power to essentially get what you want done so that your political enemies lose out.
Yeah.
You know, here's the proof. It's happening. It's happening right now.
Yeah.
And even if we can't see it, it's still happening.
Yeah, and not only that, but it's... The increases in the TSA fees, which basically get added onto your airline ticket, is that they've doubled from like $11 for a nonstop round trip up to $16 or $20, whatever it is. That is going to bring in $16.9 billion in income for the federal government to give to the TSA to hire more people, to buy more equipment, to be a bigger pain in the butt than they've been so far in the past 12 years. The gall of saying we have succeeded in stopping exactly zero terrorist attempts to bring down airplanes, but we want another $16 billion to do it.
That's a very sad thing. It's also very part and parcel with what we can typically expect from government, as we've seen over the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years. They're very consistent, consistently bad, consistently inexpert at actually producing the kinds of results that average Americans would look for, but very expert at producing the kinds of results that the people in power would like to see, and usually with some rather dire unexpected consequences along the way, that like the fallout, the symptoms of the whole thing.
Well,
case in point, the drug...
Yeah, but you have to understand. You have to understand. Government can do magic.
Yeah.
But they can't get everything perfect. And so if there's anything that isn't working quite right, or you're not particularly happy with the outcome, whether it's Obamacare or TSA or whoever it is, the solution is not to eliminate the agency or eliminate the law. The solution is, oh, we just need more money. We just need more people. And so bureaucracies, their first priority is always to expand the bureaucracy. And that's their interest, and that's their only interest.
Well, yes, that's true, and I don't doubt that at all. But where I was going with it is what the impact it has on the various kinds of major efforts that the government involves in. Case in point, the drug war. Because, let's see, the drug war has been fought since, I believe, the mid-70s. Essentially, it has succeeded totally and successfully at increasing drug use in the United States. It has totally succeeded in building up a huge criminal syndicate that never previously existed, where criminals are basically living off the suffering of individuals. It's essentially failed in almost every respect, except it has managed to put a whole bunch of nonviolent people into prison, to the point there are more people in prison in the United States than were ever in prison in either Nazi Germany or in South Africa during the apartheid era. Mm-hmm. But those little wonderful benefits aside, essentially the drug war has accomplished little or nothing, but it has created some other consequences that go along with it. We've touched on a few of them here. One of the consequences that has come up in the last few years is that because adults in South and Central America who are caught up in this drug war end up getting killed, there is a large population, a growing population of minors, children who are left behind as orphans, and many of these children end up coming to the United States. So we actually have an ongoing increase in the number of orphaned children from South and Central America trying to enter the United States, and that's becoming something of a problem.
Yeah, I mean, this is a consequence of the billions of dollars we've given to Central American countries like Honduras and Costa Rica and so on and so forth to fight the drug war. And the way they fight the drug war is basically the government gang fights the drug gang. And the drug gang has more money. In spite of our taxes, in spite of our subsidies, they got more money and more people on the payroll than any of these tiny governments do in Central America. Mm-hmm. So basically, it's a state of anarchy. It's a totally violent competition between the drug gangsters and the government. And as a consequence, there are a lot of orphans. Now, there is another mitigating factor that usually isn't mentioned in the commentary on the 54,000 underage children that have migrated in the past year or something like that, which is not mm-hmm. a really big number. It's increased a lot, but it's not really a big number in terms of overall illegal immigration. But the thing that they have not pointed out in very many of the news stories is that 6 months ago, I think it was the government of Honduras that decided that the best thing for Honduran children was to be adopted by Hondurans. In other words, they nationalized the adoption agencies and required that adoptions only be granted to parents or guardians who are in Honduras. As a consequence, the legal adoption process for not just U.S. citizens, but even Mexicans or anybody, they could no longer adopt these kids. So rather than adopting out 50 or 60,000 of these kids to people in other countries, they basically entirely eliminated the adoption system because there's nobody in Honduras who can afford to take somebody else's kid. I mean, it's cut from 56,000 per year down to something in the neighborhood of 5,000. And so that's where all these kids are coming from. Nobody is willing to adopt them. The Honduran government is in control. They can't provide the social benefits and take care of them. But then they pass a stupid law saying that nobody else can adopt their kids. And so where do the kids go? Well, they go to Mexico, and then they come to the U.S. So it's a conglomeration of mess that isn't at all surprising when you know all the different elements. Now, one of the elements, let me just tag on this little aspect to it as well. The Republicans are screaming and yelling that this is all Obama's fault, and they should be, you know, deporting all these kids, and they shouldn't be allowed in the country, and they shouldn't be allowed administrative hearings and judicial hearings about whether or not they're legitimate immigrants. Again, the thing that doesn't hit the news media is that 15 different states have already adopted what was called in the federal level the DREAM Act. And they have decided, the state legislature, including many Republican legislatures, that they are going to make special accommodations for underage minors. And so the appeal is not from the federal government level, because the DREAM Act failed in Congress. It's 15 different states that have said, yeah, we should take care of these kids. We shouldn't be, just throwing them back into Mexico. So that's another aspect of this whole problem. Again, the government created the problems, whether it's the U.S. government or the state governments or the Honduran government or Costa Rica government or this total insanity of the drug war, which is basically a racist law anyway. All of those things have contributed to this problem.
And another consequence is borne out in a story that appeared in the L.A. Times in the beginning of July about how in 2008, President Bush signed a law that the bill had an interesting name, the William Wilberforce Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act. Of course, a reference to William Wilberforce, the member of Parliament who helped to end slavery in Britain in around the turn of the 19th century. But the fact that this law was intended to prevent, or at least to block, immigration officials from sending back children to the countries they came from under the fear that they would become pimps and put into basically the sex trade and so forth, that has also contributed to this influx of children, so that when the influx comes, when the children come, as much as Republicans and perhaps some immigration officials would like to turn them away, they can't. So essentially, it has green-lighted the opportunity for more and more and more and more and more young people to come to the United States under this protection. And we're already seeing an increase in it. Like you say, the numbers aren't huge yet, but the trend is unmistakable. It's a hyperbolic trend, and if that hyperbole holds true, which seems very likely to me, we're going to get to the point where we're not seeing just tens of thousands coming in, but hundreds of thousands and perhaps even millions coming in. And boy, won't the Republicans have a fit about that one, even though their president was the one who put it into law in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't just a Republican president, Bush. It was a Republican Congress that passed this law, which is a reasonable law. It just grants due process to underage children. Mm-hmm. So they aren't just thrown back into the desert. They actually get an opportunity to explain to a judge why they're there and who's going to take care of them, and provides all kinds of contingencies that allow them to stay, whether it's family or parents that are in the country or some charitable organization that takes responsibility for them. The courts basically just process these kids and send them off to whatever kind of custodial or guardianship services they can find. And that's a requirement stipulated by Republicans in a Republican Congress with a Republican president. And so it's all Obama's fault.
Yeah, right. Well, but here it is. An unforeseen consequence. The unforeseen consequence of putting that law into place is that they basically ensure that as these children of murdered parents come to the United States in ever large numbers, there's nothing they can do to stop it. It's almost a sort of a sarcastic, well, I told you so kind of a situation.
Oh. Well, there's another incongruity, and this is something that, as long as we're criticizing Republicans, Republican conservatives are absolutely in a state of frenzy because of the anchor babies. And this is a case where a pregnant woman comes across the border and gives birth in the United States. And that child is now a U.S. citizen, and that child can now be a sponsor, even before they come of age, for the mother and for the father and for the brothers and the sisters and everybody else. Now, the amusing thing is that this is a provision in the Constitution that stipulates that anyone born in the United States is automatically a U.S. citizen.
Right.
My God, who wrote this Constitution? The Republicans are having a conniption fit when normally what they get upset about is violations of the Constitution. This is a constitutional provision. That's the way it's been since the beginning. That's what the founders intended. So it's just such a ridiculous mishmash of political gobbledygook and what do you call it, prevarication? You just ignore the bad stuff that you implemented and applied to the problem and start blaming whoever the current administration is.
Well,
in this particular case, it's got nothing to do with Obama.
Yeah, it's a tactic that's followed by both the conservatives and the liberals. I mean, when the liberals are in charge, then the conservatives accuse the liberals of violating the Constitution. And the liberals, meanwhile, say, we don't violate the Constitution. We support the Constitution. And then we just kind of slide aside on these other things that we're in favor of. And then when the conservatives get into power, they just do the same thing. They have it on, different issues, but they basically follow the same pattern. The liberals complain, oh, you're violating the Constitution. And the conservatives say, no, we're supporting the Constitution, except on these areas where we let it slide. It's the same thing, either way that you look at it.
However, the progressives...
It's basically two sides of the same coin, the way I look at it.
Yeah, on this particular issue, the progressives in the left wing are quite upset with Obama, and justifiably, because he's deported more immigrants than any prior president.
Mm-hmm.
He almost quadrupled the number of people who were being deported in comparison with Bush.
We have to stop it there because we're out of time, Bill. But
oi. Okay.
But it's been a good talk anyway, and a pleasure as usual.
Yep.
We'll see you all next week here on the Freedom News Hour Possibilities. Goodbye, everybody. Crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation.